Let's do this, the Cult of Hockey podcast. By the faithful and for the faithful, I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here tonight with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David.
So, Bruce, you were at the game, and of course, on every Canadian hockey fan's mind is what happened, the terrible tragedy in Humboldt that has reduced all of us to tears, I think. Probably several times today
several
as we think
times,
about it.
Several times in my personal case.
Yeah, me too. I just
hard to imagine people otherwise. It's just
brutal. It's it's a tragedy that hits all of us because I think all of us fundamentally understand, like, well, we put ourselves right in that place. We've all been on that bus or been in those cars on those country roads and those highways and in the winter, and we know what it's like out there on some days, and we know what hockey means to everybody and why those, it's just, you know, I don't have the words for it, honestly. It's just such a tragedy. So what happened at the game, Bruce?
Well, what they did was they did have several things sort of acknowledging. They had an announcement and moments of silence before the game. And the players, instead of lining up on their opposing blue lines, they lined up in a circle around the center ice dot with sort of, you know, orange, white around the circle. And then sort of all the players coming together on this particular one, just a symbolic little thing, but it worked to me. The Oilers had on the scoreboard, instead of the regular Oilers logo, they had a green and yellow with a oil drop background, but Broncos on it. And there was a chant that got going at one point during the game, "Let's go Broncos." And it was, it was kind of in everyone's heart, I think. And then the game got going and it was a little bit cathartic, you know, like it's a hockey game, it was fun, it was fast, you know, it was a sloppy game between two not wonderful teams, but there was a lot going on. You know, McDavid going for the scoring title, the Sedins playing their final NHL game was a big one, and people hung around right till the bitter end and went to the bitter end, the shootout and all. Eh?
Yeah. That's the thing that struck me is, you know, when these things happen, life goes on, you know, for all of us. And the game was a real reminder. Suddenly you're into the game and you see something and it makes you happy and you're into it and you forget all about it. And that's, I'm always a little bit troubled commenting and talking about these incidents because for the rest of us, they are, if the honest truth is, as much as they affect us and we're sad and touched by this and it, the people in the middle of it though, they never move on. And that's reality. It's just, it's just terrible. We can all come to grips with the fact that we come and we go in this world, you know, we're all going to leave it, but there's something particularly tragic and horrible about young people dying before they get to experience life. And those families are just going to be, we get the game and we get to move on. So, but and that's the way it works. So I can't be sad about that, I guess.
Well, it's
a necessary
sad,
thing.
Sad. You can't feel guilty about it. I guess where you're going, but it's certainly okay to be sad about it. I mean, even out here in St. Albert, we lost three boys from St. Albert in this one thing, right? Just tragic.
Yes,
I can relate from a, you know, a sort of more common perspective of, you know, motor vehicle accidents. I lost my brother in a car crash in 1975. Wow. And you know what? 43 years later, on his 65th birthday the other day, still brought me to tears. And I saw what it did to my parents, you know, and my parents, that affected them for the rest of their lives. And I just feel so bad for the parents that have had kids torn from their lives this week. That's just brutal.
Yeah, it really is. So the game itself, Bruce, it was kind of turned like this. The Sedins leaving was kind of anti-climax. Like it was, you know, with all the emotion coming from this tragedy, it put, I guess, the Sedins leaving in a different kind of context. It's part of this, the show of the NHL, and we're going to miss them. And, you know, I thought they had a pretty good night tonight. They looked good as they have all year. They could obviously keep playing and helping the Canucks, but.
Well, Daniel had a chance late in regulation, 2-2, and he was sort of right in the low slot, and he got a shot and Talbot kicked it out. And that would have been the nice ending because, you know, the sad thing about tonight's game was that if the Oilers had lost in regulation, they would have had the 7th dibs in the draft. And if they lost in overtime or the shootout, they would have had 8th dibs. But by winning the game, they moved down to 9th dibs. So it cost them 2 spots to win this game.
Yeah, that was on my mind too.
It's, you know, and I'm glad that they, you know, there was no indication that they weren't trying to win at all times, including the damn shootout. And in the end, you know, that it just wound up costing and at least reflects some integrity. But at the same time, you're thinking, well, you know, if Daniel puts that one in and we lose 3-2 in regulation, well, that's kind of a happy ending too, in a way, but
whatever. Yeah, it's not insignificant, Bruce. And I know like people will go on to the ends of time about Shirelli not getting like a draft pick thrown in on a certain deal, like let's say the Hall deal or the Maroon deal. He didn't get a second. But as we've talked about before, every spot you drop at this high end of the draft is essentially the value of a second round draft pick. So the owners, by winning that game, essentially lost 2 second round draft picks in one fell swoop. So that was on my mind, and I would have not have been unhappy. Everyone was cheering for the Sedins, and I was really cheering for them in the last 5 minutes. Because I don't want to see tanking from the team, but if they lose fair and square, I'd be okay with that too, because it's a significant drop. There's only so many good, really good players in each draft. And I've heard there's 7, for instance. One of the things I've heard recently, there's 7 in this draft. If you get past that, and you're past it, and that's how the cookie crumbles. Anyway, maybe they got good karma tonight from Bruce, and they'll win the lottery.
They're 9th, so they can finish 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, or they can finish 9th, 10th, or 11th.
Yeah.
I mean, we can boast about beating the Blackhawks and the Rangers in the standings now because of tonight's win. And if you said at the beginning of the season we'd finish ahead of the Blackhawks, you would think, well, that's pretty good. Got to be in the playoffs for sure with that.
You know, and the other reality is, as Oilers fans, we have to know this too. Mm-hmm. We can't hope forever to have all our problems solved on this team through the draft. It's not going to happen.
It hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet, and we've had all of these high draft picks. So let's get, I mean, not to underestimate their value. They can be of tremendous value. But what they really need is just a team, you know, a well-coached, well-run team with, you know, that plays better like they had last year. So, Bruce, the one thing that really did give me like real joy watching the game and kind of broke me out of the funk I was in was McDavid, RNH, and Ratty. Uh-huh. They seem to have something going on there, Bruce. Uh-huh. And Ratty's part of it, interestingly. I think he's just a smart player who goes to the front of the net and battles hard. And RNH and McDavid really pass the puck well together. They don't seem to overpass it. It's just right. It's just like a strong attacking tandem, setting each other up here, there, and everywhere. And Nuge's goal just made me really happy. So great to see that.
Yeah, that was such a nice play. I mean, Nuge made the long headman pass to McDavid, and McDavid held up the puck so long that by the time he dropped it back, Nuge had completely caught up to the play and drifted into the slot, and he fired just a beautiful hit, what I call the sackic spot, you know, just inside the stick side post, about an inch inside the post, maybe just above the pad. And Burnaby Joe used to hit that spot regularly. And Burnaby Nuge, that's his favorite spot that he shoots for. And he hit it tonight. That was a bullet.
It really is significant what's happened with Nugent Hopkins, because I wanted him on that top line with McDavid, partly as a compliment because I thought he would do well, but partly out of like not a compliment because I don't think he's as nearly as good a center on his own line as Leon Draisaitl is. I think Draisaitl is far more capable of leading his own line, which the Oilers really, really need someone who can lead that second line. And I don't actually think Nuge is that player, at least not with the wingers on this team right now. But they have found that winger for McDavid now. We don't have to think, you know, who are they going to get? Who are they going to get to play with McDavid? They have him. And if there's any indication, we have a point-a-game winger here, 70 points, 80 points, playing with McDavid all year. So that's a huge thing for this team because they have all these other holes that they have to fill. They need desperately speed and puck moving on the blue line. And they need a couple more third line, maybe third or second line players, definitely no lower than third line. And that's going to be very hard to get to fill those holes, especially with the salary cap considerations that they have. So thank goodness that that happened finally. And it's one of the few highlights of the year. And, McClellan got a lot of heat for this, justifiably, should have happened long ago, but it finally did happen. And the results were fantastic.
Fantastic enough that it just kind of raises the bar on the questioning why it took so long.
Yes, it does. That's the way it is with so much. Anything good that happens, like, why didn't that happen before? Like the penalty kill, you see Strome and Kyra out there killing it, or especially Strome. Like, why wasn't he out there from the start of the year, or at least by October? Yeah. You see the power play; they scored a goal, and I like the skill power play. Mm-hmm. They finally had Nuge down low. Mm-hmm. Why don't they utilize? They never utilize, Bruce, that kind of behind the net area. Very rarely, like these skilled players like Nugent Hopkins or Draisaitl come, or McDavid coming up from behind the net, the Gretzky office. It's like it doesn't exist in terms of their book of tactics. It all starts from the point in the half walls. And then, they might take it to the side of the net, but they never have that where they go behind the net and try to work that play, which strikes me as just, again, like I don't get it at all. It's one of the long list of things about their power play I don't get.
Now, well, one of the things I don't get about their power play is why they don't get more of them. They've been keeping track of a number of power play opportunities since 1979, which is when the Oilers entered the league. And throughout the 248-game stub seasons that follow two of the three Bettman lockouts, and, of course, the other one had no season at all, so you get rid of those two seasons, and of the other, 36 seasons, the 2017-18 Edmonton Oilers set a record for fewest power play opportunities, 210 power play opportunities for an entire season. The fewest in the entire time they've been keeping the record. This is with the scoring champion on the team and the player who last year, somehow not this year, but last year led the league in drawing penalties. And this year, by eye, he should have drawn a lot of penalties, but the Zebras, for whatever reason, there was, 210 power plays for the entire season, like 2.5 a game.
Yeah, they were few and far between.
And then they had, of course, the worst conversion rate. So if you have both the fewest number of power plays and you convert your number of power plays at the worst rate, well, you're doomed to finish.
You had that wonderful chart the other.
Oh, brutal, eh? They got up to 30. They got up to 31 in the end. So at least they got into the next category. There wasn't that gap with the zero, where that really was. And I didn't cheat for that. I just sort of used natural bins, and they were just so far out of whack. There were two bins over the worst.
I think there was many faults of that power play, but when I think about, like, if I was to say what the main one was last year, what made that power play go as much as anything was they found in Mark Letestu a guy with a shot from that left circle who who suddenly changed the dynamic. They couldn't focus necessarily all their energy on Draisaitl and McDavid. They had to start, he loosened things up and he scored regularly. And not having that, not he was unable to execute. He lost a step over the summer. And they never found, Strome was never the answer. And they refused to put Puljujärvi there, who has shown at other levels of hockey, he's got a brilliant shot from that spot. To me, that not, I'm okay actually with the way they've handled Puljujärvi at even strength, but not using him on the power play there. It was one of those, it's up there with how long it took them to go to RNH, but it's even higher because they never did do it. And, you know, I guess they might have had political reasons, like they don't want to give the rookie top power play time and let it go to his head or whatever, you know, the inner team things are. But, man, we don't know how he would have done, how he could have done, how that would have changed the dynamic with him and with the team. And that was a huge lost opportunity and, to me, a sign of, again, organizational incompetence, which is what we were facing with when they weren't using RNH and looking at trading the guy before they even knew if he could play with McDavid. I mean, that's where we were.
Yeah.
You know, that's where all the talking heads were. Oh, RNH is on the block. And now it's the same with Puljujärvi. Well, is Puljujärvi going to make it or not? Mm-hmm. Well, how about play him in his natural spot on the power play, you dunderheads, so he can see if he actually works there. And then we'll have more knowledge about it. So I'm a little hot about that, Bruce.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Last year, the Oilers, the power play goals, the leaders on the Oilers, Lucic had 12, Letestu had 11, Draisaitl had 10. I had three guys that were regularly pumping them home. This year, the leaders were Draisaitl with 6, McDavid with 5, Nugent Hopkins with 4. Nobody else more than 3. So from 12, 11, 10 to 6, 5, 4, your leading guys. There was just nobody that really got hot on the year. And in fact, Leon, who had 0, you know, sort of halfway through the year, he eventually got one tonight, and that gave him the team lead with all of 6 on the year.
He did get a little hot when they started to use him more in his natural shooting spot, which is the right the right circle.
Yeah.
Hey, one player I liked tonight, Bruce, was Darnell Nurse. Yeah. He was in on 10 even strength scoring chances, played team high 27 minutes. Mm-hmm. He was one of the few bright spots of the year. I mean, he did start – his defensive game started to crumble a bit as the year went on, and he was thrust into number one duty on the team. Mm-hmm. He struggled to handle all of those great forwards night in, night out, not unexpectedly. But he held his own in a way kind of – I think played at a kind of a level that we might have seen from Jeff Petrie a few years ago. And but he offers a little bit different than Petrie because he's a much more physical hockey player.
Yeah.
So overall, I think he gets a passing grade on the Oilers. And I don't think he gets a passing grade on the top pairing, but he gets a passing grade as a top four D man. I think he's shown he can play in the top four, which we heading into the year, we didn't know that for sure, did we?
No, not really. So, He wasn't a regular in the top four last year, and of course he missed a big chunk of the year with a nasty injury last year. And this year, I think he played every game, and he was a minute muncher tonight. He, as you say, 27 minutes and 20 seconds. That's a huge game. 6 shots on net, which is a tremendous number for a D man. And he was, you know, he was very noticeable out there and watching the live game. Like, you don't track necessarily the stats while in the arena, but he seemed to be in the middle of a lot of different things, including a scrum or two, which I didn't mind. And I'm hoping that he gets a chance to go to World Championships, you know. I think it would do him good.
I think it would do Team Canada good. I think he's earned it. I think they should pick up Chris Russell too. I think Chris Russell had a solid year. So it was interesting, Bruce. It was depressing and interesting at the same time. You did this thing today where you went through the 20 questions that you asked about the Oilers heading into the year. And in terms of affirmative answers, and it was like essentially in each question you're asking, is this player going to come through or not? That was the gist of each question. And I think I counted about 2 or 3 of the 20 questions. I don't know if you did a full count, but it was only about affirmatively challenge that was ahead of him. It was not many.
Yeah. I mean, in the case, some of the questions were unfair. I mean, the one of Chris Russell was, can he cover off for Andre Sekera? Well, A, that's a tall order. B, last year he was part of the Andre Sekera equation. They were a pair, and this year he didn't have his partner.
Yeah.
And
a better question for him would have been, can he play well even without Andre Sucker. And I think we would say, I would say yes. I mean, but I think most of the questions were entirely fair. And it was
fun to revisit them.
The players have underperformed almost to a man on this roster.
Yeah,
is the truth. And I think that is on the coach.
Well, it was interesting to revisit those questions. I mean, they were laid out with a sort of an air of optimism at the beginning of the season. If these things happen, then the team's going to be solid. Well, most of those things, as you say, didn't happen, with the notable exception, certainly, of Connor McDavid. And a couple of nice items about Nurse and Kara and guys that, you know, definitely take a step. But there was a bunch more guys that didn't take a step.
Yeah. All right. So the scoring chances tonight were 25-25. It was a busy night for Jonathan Willis and I. I want to give a shout out to Jonathan. I want to give a shout out to Jonathan, who has all year worked on the scoring chance project with us. And it's been fantastic to collaborate with him on that project and given us, and it's improved the fairness and accuracy of the information. Mm-hmm. Considerably, and it wasn't easy to do that work together, but we did it, and I'm really happy with it.
You guys put in a tremendous effort, and I was sort of the cleanup guy when you guys, on those rare occasions that you didn't agree, which was frankly a small percentage, after you talked over with each other, you generally we're on the same page on things. But that process of talking things over and revisiting plays, I think it did definitely refine the process and made for results that we all three can be pretty confident in. And
I think what it showed me, go ahead.
The ones that I got were sort of very borderline plays, and they were kind of the tricky ones. And it was kind of fun to look at that and just see, well, where is it where Dave and John don't quite see eye to eye? And you know, a huge majority of them were defensive. The offensive contributions are a little bit more straightforward to judge, and the defensive ones, a lot of them are errors of omission, right? And you have to sort of say, well, where was the guy doing, and where could he have been? And whereas offensively, usually they've either handled the puck or they've done something very specific, like drive the net, screen the goalie, do something easily seen as a contributing factor. And the defensive side of it is just a much trickier, tougher call. And I think anybody trying to do a project like that would have the same issue.
Yeah, I think Bill James I interviewed him at one of those Massachusetts conferences, and he said the hardest thing in any sport is coming up with the defensive stats. I mean, the offensive stats are relatively easy. And they are in hockey as well, even in something like scoring, you know, contributions to scoring chances. It's the defensive stats that are harder to gauge. I would say that one thing I learned is that as the year went on, and we both understood the criteria, the agreed upon criteria, better. As our understanding came to meet, there were far fewer disagreements. And that's one of the things I noticed. So Bruce, let's end off. We're going to be talking this week about, we'll do, you know, kind of a full recap of the team going forward. We haven't actually plotted it out, but we will be starting in on that. We'll probably look at the coach, the GM, all the different positions, and do a podcast on each of those things. Let's end off with our secret good thing of the night. And mine is that I'm going to go full McCurdy on this and turn this into a negative, Bruce. It was Camilleri missing the shootout shot. Because if he had scored that shootout shot, I think they might have been tempted to bring him back next year. And even though I didn't mind him as a fourth line center, he's the kind of old veteran player that the coach, if he's back, and it's, you know, I think he could well be if McClellan's back, he loves those old veterans like Letestu and Korpikoski. So I was having this terrible feeling he was going to score, and then we'd see him on the power play and penalty kill next year. So. Because he missed, he's lost his hands. Just reinforces that narrative, which is in fact true.
Right. I thought he scored in the shootout.
Oh Jesus, he did.
I thought
what am I saying?
That super slick move of his. He missed a chance in overtime. He cut in. He had to do it fast.
Oh, geez, I got confused. You're right. That's
he came in off the wing like he does in the shootout, off the left wing boards, and then the shootout. And he opened up Anders Nilsson like a can opener.
Slipped
at five hole. He did the same thing to three different goalies on shootouts this year. It just made him look foolish. But
he did. And I was thinking of that overtime. That's what I was thinking. Oh, thank goodness he missed that. And then, of course, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they will bring him back.
Well, you know what? He had a pretty good game tonight, and he was good in the faceoff circle, 11 and 4. Four shots on net, seven shot attempts, playing center with a couple of relative plumbers.
I don't mind him, actually, as a player.
But I'm not sure it's going to be here.
I just fear he would be overused. It just seems every year there's some veteran player who just can't get it done, who's like out there all the time. So, I mean, this year we had a couple of them. But that's my concern about Camilleri, so that he'd come back and be that guy. All right, Bruce, what's your secret good thing?
My secret good thing is, I'm going to chintz out and say Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. I mean, we already did talk about him, but playing left wing and playing with McDavid. And he had a very, very nice game with a goal and assist. End of the year, 24-24. He basically played three quarters of a season. You could prorate his season. And he's up to .32-32. You know, that's a pretty nice year. And if you really were to drill down and say just how he did when he played with McDavid, he really had it going on.
Do you know what the numbers are off the top of your head?
With McDavid,
it was at least
over a point a game. Because he had two tonight, and he had at least one on Thursday night, and he missed the two games before that, and he was over a point a game when he went out, when he was hurt.
Yeah, he just looked fantastic there, and I think that they probably will have it in their head going forward that that's the top line, and I wonder if they'll keep Ratty there. I have to see. I'm sure he won't be a lock, but he'll be a cheap signing, and he'll be in competition for that. He's quite a controversial player already, you know. Like, of course, every Oilers player has his strong facts, but he's already like raising the ire of some people, saying it's a small sample size and the percentages are high. Like, of course, right? Like, they've scored a ton in a short amount of time. That's how it works when a line gets hot. But it doesn't mean they can't function. It doesn't mean they won't be good. I mean, it does mean you don't give Ratty a 3-year contract, but it doesn't mean that you don't give him a 1-year contract. Like, you still can sign him if you think he could be a useful player. So,
mm-hmm. One year. It seems to me to be a no-brainer from both sides. So I really do expect it's going to happen. 1-year contract for Ratty, possibly two, but more likely one, and something below what I call the AHL burial rate, which is the amount of contract you send to the AHL where none of it shows up on your cap. And something like 1.05 million. And I think he'll probably be, you know, under a million. And so if he comes in and somebody beats him out, they can send him down and it's not going to have any cap implications, but they'll give him a fair shot. And he'll also be a call-up option. Like, he's a pretty reasonable guy to have around.
One of the advantages of being a team with some money, and I think the Oilers are that team, is that they could give him 2 years at $2 million, right? Because then you're covered in case he does have a good year, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, then you don't have to sign him up for more money, but you can just send him to the minors, and all it costs you is the money that you're paying him in the minors. It doesn't cost you anything against the cap. So it's probably one of the reasons they should have signed Pitlick last summer, because I don't think he sign for much more than $1 million a year? I don't think he did.
3 years for, I think it was one, or it might have been 1.1. I think it was 1 million.
Yeah. So that's a deal the Oilers should have been looking at with Pitlick, and I don't know why that didn't happen. It's one of the few things, like, of Shirley's mistakes, it's rarely mentioned. But to me, it's one of the bigger ones, that and a backup goal here.
He was a group six, though, and with his injury history, I mean, Dallas, he did become a free agent. And Dallas offered him more.
But the Oilers could have signed him before July 1st.
Yeah, they could have.
They had a long time to sign him. They had a long time to sign him, Bruce, when they had exclusive negotiation rights.
But they weren't prepared to offer 2 or 3 years of a one-way contract, and Dallas did, and more power to him. As for Ratty, the thing about him is they signed him for 1 year. He's 25 now.
Yeah.
He's going to be a group six this summer because he's 25 and he hasn't played 80 NHL games. He's played 48 games. But yeah. I signed him for a one-year contract, and he plays half the year here next year. He will then be an RFA because he'll have his 80 games, and he won't be 27. So they would have exclusive negotiating rights. So a one-year deal makes a lot of sense from Edmonton's perspective. They can cut bait after 1 year, or they can qualify him. If he's 26 years old and he has a good year, then they've got rights to him.
Ah, fair enough. If they can qualify him, that changes the equation in getting that second year.
He's a group six right now, but next year, assuming he gets 32 more NHL games, he won't be. And if he doesn't get 32 games, I'd probably want to cut bait anyway, right?
Yeah. All right, Bruce, let's leave it there.
All right. We'll have more to chat about, I'm sure, as time goes on, but congrats to McDavid on the scoring title. Congrats to the Sedin brothers. What a class act those guys were again tonight and have been throughout. It's the league is going to be the poorer for their departure, but more power to them.
Fantastic hockey players. All right. Thanks for talking, Bruce.
Thanks for listening, everyone. 82 games, David. We did 82 podcasts.
Yes, 80, felt like 8,200 sometimes. And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.